Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Once again from London, England. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Well, where are we going to get our energy from? It seems a question we are wrestling with these days, and the answers are not here. A recently published study by researchers at the University of Texas at Arlington found elevated levels of arsenic and other heavy metals.
Yeah, heavy metal.
In groundwater near natural gas fracking sites in Texas's Barnett Shale. What the frack? While the findings are far from conclusive, the study provides further evidence tying fracking to arsenic contamination. An internal EPA PowerPoint presentation recently obtained by the Los Angeles Times, they still have one, warned that wells near Dimock, Pennsylvania, showed elevated levels of arsenic in the groundwater. The EPA also found arsenic in groundwater near fracking sites in Pavilion, Wyoming, in 2009, in a study that the agency later abandoned. You don't need to study that. But arsenic is good for you, right? Speaking of energy, one of the great sources of my energy over the years, especially as I was growing up, was the great American satirist Stan Freberg, who this week celebrated his 87th birthday. Happy birthday, Stan. Speaking of energy.
Clean, safe, too cheap to meet.
Our friend the Atom.
Safe, cheap, too cheap to meet. Cheap, safe, too safe to meet. Safe, safe, too safe to meet.
Addy, our friend the Atom, is here with us in London. What'd you do this week?
Celebrated the anniversary of the Olympics by staying home.
Okay. Highly radioactive water seeping into the ocean from Japan's crippled Fukushima plant is creating an, quote, emergency, unquote, that the operator is struggling to contain, according to Japan's nuclear watchdog, as reported by Reuters. The contaminated groundwater had breached an underground barrier, was rising towards the surface, and exceeded legal limits of radioactive discharge, says the head of the Nuclear Regulatory Authority Task Force. Countermeasures planned by TEPCO are only a temporary solution, he said. TEPCO's sense of crisis is weak, the official said. This is why you can't just leave it up to TEPCO alone to deal with the situation. Right now, he adds, we have an emergency. TEPCO has been widely castigated for its failure to prepare for the tsunami and earthquake. It was not immediately clear how much of a threat the contaminated groundwater could pose. The toxic water release was heavily criticized by the neighboring countries, as well as fishermen. And the utility has since promised not to dump irradiated water without consent of local town authorities. Until we know exact density and volume of the water that's flowing out, I honestly can't speculate on the impact on the sea, says Mitsuo Umatsu of the Center for International Collaboration, Atmosphere and Ocean Research Institute at the University of Tokyo. TEPCO says it's taking measures to prevent contaminated water from leaking into the bay near the plant. A company spokesman said TEPCO deeply apologized to residents in Fuk Prefecture for causing inconveniences, worries, and trouble. The utility pumps out 400 tons a day of groundwater flowing from the hills above the Fuk nuclear plant into the basements of the destroyed building. There it mixes with highly irradiated water that's used to cool the reactors. TEPCO is trying to prevent groundwater from reaching the plant by building a bypass, but recent spikes of radioactive elements in seawater have prompted the utility to reverse months of denials and finally admit that tainted water is reaching the sea.
So what else is new?
Oh, I'll tell you what else is new. Since you asked, Dateline Taipei, a nuclear power plant in Taiwan, may have been leaking radioactive water for 3 years, according to a report published by the government's watchdog, adding to the uncertainty of the fate of a new fourth nuclear power plant on the island.
You know, maybe the watchdogs are out of control.
They are loose. The first nuclear power plant located at Ximen, in a remote northern coastal location but not far from densely populated Taipei, the capital, has been leaking toxic water from storage pools of two reactors, said the watchdog. An official of Taiwan Power Company, which operates the island's nuclear power plant, said the water did not come from the storage pools, but may have come from condensation or water used for cleaning up the floor.
Condensation can't hurt you.
We've explained to the authority, but they turned it down. They asked us to look if other causes were involved, said the official. He declined to be identified as the matter is sensitive.
Hey, who isn't?
Good point. In any case, the water has been collected in a reservoir next to the storage pools used for spent nuclear rods. The control watchdog agency said there's been a catalog of errors, including a lack of a proper plan for how to handle spent nuclear materials, and it did not believe the explanations from the company. Nothing, right?
Yeah, this skepticism is unseemly.
Dateline St. Petersburg, Florida, the largest utility in the U.S., is scuttling plans to build a $24.7 billion nuclear power plant in a small Gulf Coast county in Florida, the company announced Thursday. Duke Energy says it made the decision because of delays by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in issuing licenses for new plants and because of recent legislative changes in Florida.
See, it's all the regulator's fault.
Nah. But Duke did not close the door entirely on the Levy County project. The company said it will still attempt to pursue a license for the plant, perhaps in late 2014 or 2015. We continue to believe that the Levy site is a viable option for future nuclear generation, said a company official. Duke would have to evaluate energy factors before deciding whether new nuclear generation makes sense, he said. You have to look at project cost. You have to look at what are the energy needs. You have to look at carbon regulations. Is there a carbon tax? You have to look at, for the long term, what you think natural gas prices are going to do, the official said. The announcement comes just a few years after U.S. nuclear industry executives said they were on a cusp of a revival.
It's a long cusp.
That revival has fallen short. The proposed plant and how the company was raising money for it have been debated for some time in Florida. The debate centers around this fact. Duke has been charging its customers nuclear cost recovery fees for the two planned 1,100 megawatt units in Levy County. Through these fees, so far, Duke's customers have paid $1.5 billion for the plant so far, even though up to now, the plant's not being built. If Duke got those funds, that $1.5 billion, from investors, Duke Energy would have to pay interest, but not to its customers.
That's why they're called customers.
Back to Tokyo, the operator of the Fuuk plant has given its first public estimate of the size of the leakage of radioactive tritium into the Pacific Ocean. Between 20 trillion and 40 trillion becquerels of the substance is estimated to have leaked into the sea since May 2011, says TEPCO, the first such figure TEPCO has released. TEPCO says the scale of the radioactive tritium leak was around the level which had been allowed under safety regulations before the accident, 22 trillion becquerels annually at the plant.
That's a lot of becquerels, but not too many.
The utility says it would also now estimate the amount of cancer-causing strontium, which may have leaked over the past couple of years. The utility says the levels of underground water have risen as workers built shields to prevent groundwater from seeping out into the ocean. What do you think would happen when you build a wall to keep water from going out? The water rises.
Don't start with your physics.
Foreign nuclear experts have blasted TEPCO's lack of transparency over radioactive leaks. Dale Klein, former head of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, told a panel in Tokyo, TEPCO doesn't know what they're doing. They do not have a plan, and they're not doing all they can to protect the environment and the people. And the Wall Street Journal reports, TEPCO's preparing this week to start on a new set of measures designed to ring off and cap the area where the most highly contaminated water has been found. But some experts and regulators are saying the battle to completely contain radioactivity to the site may be a losing one. In the most recent example of the struggle, the company says rising levels of contaminated groundwater may have already topped the sunken barrier the utility started only a month ago and wasn't even expecting to complete until late this particular week. The government will provide support and money for an ambitious project that calls for a sunken wall potentially made of ice, completely encircling the crippled reactors to keep groundwater out. Building a ceiling wall of this magnitude has never been done before, said government spokesman Mr. Suga at a Wednesday morning news conference. TEPCO's current measures, like pumping up contaminated water and putting it in storage, are merely a temporary solution, according to Shunichi Tanaka, chairman of the Nuclear Regulation Authority. Eventually, it will be necessary to discharge water that is still contaminated into the sea, he said. Back to this frozen barrier. The groundwater has risen to a meter below the surface, already above the level of the underground barrier, which starts 1.8 meters down. But there is risk in changing the flow of groundwater in the ways that TEPCO is considering. According to Tatsuya Chinkawa, Nuclear Accident Response Director of the Ministry of Economy, Trade and Industry, the water could pool dangerously underground, softening the earth and potentially toppling the reactor buildings, he said. Freezing the soil has its own problems, according to Kumio Watanabe, a geology professor at Saitama University. The technology, which is used in civil engineering to dig tunnels, may be able to cut down the amount of groundwater entering the contaminated site, but it's expensive. You'll need hundreds of millions of yen to build a system, Watanabe said. You'll also need a large amount of electricity to maintain the ice walls.
Oh, they can make electricity.
Yeah. Clean, cheap, safe, two-thing meter, our friend the atom. And now, ladies and gentlemen, let's get secret. Details of a U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration program that feeds tips to federal agents and then instructs them to alter the investigative trail were published in a manual used by agents of the IRS for 2 years. This practice, recreating the investigative trail, highly criticized by former prosecutors and defense lawyers after it was reported by Reuters this week, is now under review by the Justice Department. A 350-word entry in the Internal Revenue Manual instructed agents of the agency to omit any reference to tips supplied by the DEA's Special Operations Division, especially from keeping it out of affidavits, court proceedings, or investigative files. The entry was published and posted online in 2005 and 2006. An IRS spokesman had no comment on the entry or why it was removed from the manual. As Reuters reported Monday, the Special Operations Division of the DEA funnels information from overseas NSA intercepts, domestic wiretaps, informants, and a huge DEA database of telephone records to authorities nationwide to help them launch criminal investigations of Americans. This is your brain on the war on drugs. The DEA phone database is separate from the NSA database. Reuters cited internal government reports that show that law enforcement agents have been trained to conceal how such investigations truly begin, to recreate the investigative trail to effectively cover up the original source of the information. This is known as parallel construction. Paging Mr. Orwell, and the National Security Agency has a secret back door into its vast databases under a legal authority enabling it to search for U.S. citizens' email and phone calls without a warrant, according to a top-secret document passed to The Guardian by whistleblower Edward Snowden. The previously undisclosed rule change allows NSA operatives to hunt for individual Americans' communications using their name or other identifying information. Senator Ron Wyden told The Guardian the NSA's authorities provide loopholes that allow warrantless searches for the phone calls or emails of law-abiding Americans. This authority, approved 2 years ago, appears to contrast with repeated assurances from President Obama that the privacy of U.S. citizens is protected from the NSA's dragnet surveillance programs. The intelligence data is being gathered under Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act, which gives the NSA authority to target without warrant the communications of foreign targets who must be non-U.S. citizens and outside the U.S. This is the first evidence the NSA has permission to search those databases for specific U.S. individuals' communications. A secret back door, eh?
I'm the secret back door man. Yep, I'm the secret back door man. When you're on your computer, when you're on your phone, even when you're all by yourself, you never walk alone. And when it's bedtime and you're too anxious to count sheep, while you're surfing, I'm making my midnight peep. I'm the secret backdoor man. Yep, I'm the secret backdoor man. Congress doesn't know, but the NSA understands. Mm-hmm. You got financial info? You got murmurs of the heart? Gotta collect them. Gotta do my part. Just in case you know someone who knows someone who knows a suspicious panda at the zoo. I'm the secret backdoor man. Yep. The secret backdoor man. The civilians don't know, but the spooks understand. We're not supposed to collect it. Not supposed to keep it. What we do with it all? Well, that's a secret. Don't need to come in darkness, because the light can't go this deep. Don't even bother dreaming, because I monitor your sleep. I'm the secret backdoor man. Yep, I'm the secret backdoor man. The lawyers don't know, but the secret judges understand.
From London, this is Le Show, and I'm joined today by probably my favorite whistleblower. You may remember her from this broadcast or from the documentary film about the 2005 New Orleans flood, The Big Uneasy. She was and is an employee of the United States Army Corps of Engineers, but has whistleblower protection, and she's in Los Angeles today, Maria Garzino. Maria, welcome back.
Hello, Harry. Very glad to be here.
Well, great to have you here. The occasion for this conversation, ladies and gentlemen, is last year there was a hurricane that passed to the west of New Orleans, Hurricane Isaac, but it brought some rainfall and some issues to New Orleans, and it was advertised after the fact as the first real test of the hurricane risk reduction system, the $14 billion system that the United States Army Corps of Engineers built after the catastrophic flooding of New Orleans in 2005 to supposedly protect the city. And as I say, it was advertised as a the first example of the system working. Now, some 11 months or 10, 11 months later, a blogger in New Orleans by the name of Matt McBride had issued Freedom of Information Act requests to the Army Corps for their internal emails during the period of Hurricane Isaac. And they have become public in the last few weeks. And that's what I've asked Maria to discuss here today. She did not participate in the FOIA action, but she is an expert on much of this system. She supervised the testing and installation of the hydraulic pumps at the heart of the system in New Orleans. And so I've asked for her guidance as we talk about some of the points raised by these newly published emails. First, and this had become sort of, I hesitate to use the pun, but it had leaked out publicly before these emails, problems with the water level gauges in the three canals that connect New Orleans to Lake Pontchartrain. These are the canals into which rainwater is pumped by the city by very efficient pumps, and that the water normally then goes into the lake, and that's how the city gets, to use a Corps of Engineers word, dewatered. But there are problems with these canals. The flood walls that the Corps built some decades ago have problems, which were revealed in 2005. They've never been fixed, and so the Corps has mandated a new, lower, safe water level for these canals, and the water level gauges are necessary to for the Corps to know how high the water is. We learned during Isaac there's a problem with those gauges. Do you have some insight into why that is, how that could be?
Yes, actually, the FOIA documents with the internal emails were very clear. They gave a very good picture. In addition to what we had learned originally, what caught my attention was what was reported forward by the Corps at the time was everything was fine. All the gauges worked. I think there was even an article printed the day of the storm by the New York Times that said that they were reporting water levels and referring to the gauges as providing those water levels. But we later learned that, in fact, there was massive SCADA data failures and the gauges, the majority of which were malfunctioning, not working properly.
SCADA is
it's basically a computerized system to collect all the data and transmit data back and forth.
And the New Orleans website, the Lens, reported earlier this year, I believe, that the problem with the gauges had to do with the way they were installed by the Corps. Is that correct?
Yes. It was. It had a great deal to do with the installation methods as well as the engineering of what they actually bought. I think there were issues with wind shear and other things, too. I think at the time the Lens offered that 6 of the 8 gauges at 17th Street Canal were malfunctioning at the time during the storm. And they even reported, which was a little disturbing, that one of the gauges registered over 8 feet before it stopped working. The safe water level at 17th Street is 6.5 feet. At the time, we were told that water levels at 17th Street Outfall Canal by the Corps had reached 6, at the most 6.5 feet. And what we later learned with these internal emails was because there was this massive failure of the gauges, they're reporting the data, they're malfunctioning. What the Corps had actually done is, and what you do in that instance, you send people out into the storm to get a visual, to kind of eyeball what the water level is in the canal, and that's what they were doing. The internal emails were showing that they were getting, I believe, half-hour interval readings from people going out and eyeballing it and reporting back. None of this data was reported forward to the Emergency Ops Center and reported forward to the embedded journalists also, or reported out to the public. They were instead told everything's working fine.
So those are the gauges. Now let's get to what's really at the heart of this story, which is the pumps. These pumps, which you know intimately, are there,
yes,
to pump the water in the canals into the lake when gates are closed to prevent storm surge from the lake from coming backward into the canals and thereby flooding the city. And there are two sets of pumps, the hydraulic pumps, which I think you proved definitively, and you were vetted by outside engineering consultants hired by the Office of Special Counsel to examine your work, that the hydraulic pumps were incapable of working in hurricane conditions. But we were told at the time that your reports first became public that, there are these other pumps, direct drive pumps, and they work perfectly, so you don't have to worry about the hydraulic pumps. Now, I think the emails that have been made public reveal there were problems with the direct drive pumps as well?
Correct, Harry. There were, and that was very surprising at the time. As you know, the reason for those direct drives also has to do with the fact that during the process of testing and installing the hydraulic pumps, my trying to bring forward the issues of deep embedded systemic system deficiencies and later proving them to be essentially, the moment you turn the hydraulic pumps on, they essentially start destroying themselves. There's no way to keep them going from an engineering standpoint. The systems, the components of the systems, you can't rely on them. They will start destroying themselves. What I found through the long process of the investigatory process and onward is the Corps also came to understand that these are not the type of pumps that they wanted to continue putting in. They had originally put in 34, or they had put in 32 pumps, and they bought an additional few pumps to install at London Avenue and at 17th Street, but then they changed dramatically after my coming forward with the defective nature. They decided to go with direct drive pumps instead, to augment the pumps that they installed at 17th Street. I believe they put in 11 direct drive pumps there. They also put in 8 direct drive pumps at London Avenue Canal. So those pumps were, once the Corps came forward and said, we have, with these additional direct dive pumps that are inherently supposed to be more
robust,
less prone to, yes, much more robust, less prone to, well, tried and true. They're very, that's what should have probably gone in the beginning. But that aside, essentially, once small storms started showing up, the Army Corps started, this came out during the investigatory process, see, we made it through the storm and we turned on hydraulic pumps. And I was trying to explain that through FOIA data of my own, that's not the case. They were misstating these. They were actually running direct drive pumps while they were purporting to be running, here, look at the hydraulics run. Mm. And the problem with that is you'd say, look at the discharge pipe. Those are connected to direct drive pumps. Mm. Duh. But there were people, media, that showed up with TV cameras running this that had no clue. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people, essentially, I was feeling safe in the fact that the Corps was very comfortable with the operational abilities of their direct drive pumps. What was disturbing to me was during this storm, two things happened. They actually lost direct drive pumps at 17th Street, which never got reported forward. I believe the articles that came from the embedded journalists said all the pumps worked great. Mm-hmm. In truth, at any one time, well, three of the hydraulic pumps at Orleans were completely non-operational, three of the 10. They had, for all purposes, just 70% of any pumping capacity, even if they used it. And you have to remember, this was a very small storm, mm-hmm. so there was very little use for pumping. But during this process and those internal emails, something very interesting came out. They actually, a couple days before, I believe, I'm not sure, they had gone to the outside contractor for the programming of these pump direct drive pumps and asked them to basically, they wanted to override the safety shutdowns on two of the direct drive pumps. One was experiencing, I believe, low gearbox oil pressure, and one was experiencing excessive vibration. So instead of having the pumps come up and experiencing these things and the automatic shutdown shut the pumps off, they wanted to override this so that the pumps would run until, I guess, a destruction if you don't shut them off manually.
Run until they fry.
Yes. It's they're in a destructive mode, which is why you have that emergency shutdown capability built into it in a computerized form. The SCADA, everything senses that and then shuts these things down. Essentially, what you're doing, as I said, is you're hardwiring that pump to run no matter what. Mm-hmm. And you're relying on an outside individual to be watching it very carefully. Well, there's really no way to have a human being have the same efficiency and competence that a computer has in sensing these things. And you're dealing with a multi-million dollar pump. And in addition to that, the only reason to really take that kind of a risk is if you absolutely need that pumping capability, I would read into that. And in addition, if you're looking at running that pump until it dies, you're looking at getting whatever little bit more pumping capacity you can get out of it, if you absolutely need it. You have to remember that you have to keep the safe water level down in the canals, no matter what. If you exceed it, which they apparently did and did not report forward, you take the risk of the levees once again breaching and flooding the city. So it's a rather critical issue that never brought forward.
And that was a risk that the Corps, in fact, did take for at least, what, 2 or 3 hours on the day of Hurricane Isaac. Is that correct?
Yes, and there really wasn't much need. This was a very small storm. There wasn't much need for pumping. In addition to this, they actually had a number of direct drives go out. This was, I had thought that they were extremely reliable because they're going to need to be very reliable. You can't count on these hydraulic pumps in the event of a major storm. But it turns out, from what I can see from the internal emails, they also had, I believe at one point, they had as many as, I want to say 4 hydraulic pumps out and 3 direct drives. And I think at the final reporting, they managed to get, I really don't know. We don't have all the internal documents. So we really don't know exactly what happened out there. We only have a small amount of information through these small amount of FOIA documents to tell us. What we're finding out is none of this information was ever brought forward.
By the embedded reporters at the time.
Well, you have to understand, the embedded reporters are sitting right there. They're in the emergency ops center. They're looking right at the screen that says issues, as they wrote in their stories. That's being reported forward to the commander, and the commander is telling them there are no issues.
Do we have any idea, any clue from the emails that have been published so far, what the problem with the direct drive pumps is?
No, I really don't have any clear understanding of what exactly is preventing these pumps from operating seamlessly through a hurricane event.
The Corps is in the process of bidding out, right? I think they've finally bid out the contract for the replacement of this whole system, the so-called temporary system, which has been in place since 2006. With a new system that will not, by the Corps' own schedule, be installed, completed until 2017. So New Orleans will have been in this mode for 11 years. Do you know what kind of pumps are supposed to be in the new permanent system?
I don't exactly have a clear idea exactly what's going to be put out there. My understanding is these are going to be direct drive 2, which are inherently more reliable. Mm-hmm. Than most any other design.
Given the state of the gauges and given the state of the pumps during what you have described as a rather small hurricane, what should these emails tell us about the state of the system that's supposed to be protecting New Orleans right now?
I think that the biggest thing that these emails tell us has to do with the lack of transparency and accountability that's coming forward from Corps leaders. That, to me, is what really rang out. I think that what comes across in a very powerful way, there were a tremendous amount of failures going on at the time of the storm. In addition to the gauges, in addition to the pumps, there were equally serious issues with electrical system failures that could cause something quite catastrophic to happen that never got reported forward. There were a number of other things happening that you can read in these emails that were rather disturbing. And what I was most disturbed about went to the heart of the lack of transparency that was inherent in the reporting forward. The little bit that we do know about the condition of that system is not good. I suspect what really is going on with this system is far worse than what we really do know. That's inherent with a very poorly designed engineering system, which that is. It's a very poorly designed system. And from that, flows a myriad of possibilities. Anything and everything is pretty much possible. We're not getting the kind of responses that we should be getting. We had this problem. We're looking into it. This is what we're going to do to fix it. Mm-hmm. This is not what's happening. What's happening is we don't have a problem. And that, to me, is more disturbing.
Yeah. You referred to other problems. I think we were talking before we began taping about problems with some of the gates themselves. These are the gates that, as a hurricane approaches, would be closing to prevent a hurricane storm surge from spilling from the lake into the canals that would end up flooding the city. What happened with those gates? They're supposed to be automatic, right?
Well, they are. And essentially, the reason they're automatic is for a number of reasons, but it gives you a lot of, it gives you the option of dropping the gates when you need them. And it could be that you don't need to close, most times you don't need to close those mm-hmm. gates during a small storm. And I suspect even during most of the storms that we've seen, I don't think the gates really needed to have been closed. In this case, however, if those automatic hoist systems don't work, then you have to close those gates and you have to induce pumping because you can't be taking the chance that if you need to close the gates during a storm, you really can't do it. You can't go out and get a crane and personnel to stand there in the middle of a storm. So two things happened. One was at London Avenue Outfall Canal, there was a failure of when they went to close the gates, they couldn't secure them. Four of the 11 gates were partially secured. One of the segments, in addition, one of the segments was completely fully unsecured. Mm. And this was not, again, reported forward. They actually reported forward. Everything's secured perfect. And when you can't secure gates properly, there's protocol built into operating procedures. You're supposed to go out and drop very large sandbags with a crane in front of those unsecured gates. That's to mitigate what possibly might happen. It's not the best thing you can. You'd rather have it secured, but you need to mitigate what might happen during a storm with those unsecured gates. The internal emails show that there was a discussion back and forth, and someone said essentially, I think we're fine. We don't need to drop bags, do we? And someone said, no, we're going to waive that requirement. They waived mandatory protocol. Mm. And again, they reported forward, everything's fine with the gates. Mm-hmm. And only through these emails do we see, no, everything was not fine. And you waived mandatory safety protocol. And you didn't tell anybody. And of course, no harm, no foul.
This time.
It happens. Who knows? Yeah, no harm, no foul. And it's a tiny storm. What's going to happen? The problem with that is that's transparency. Because you wonder, well, why would someone do that? Well, I think the emails also show us why someone would do that. But that's another. But what we see is it's very hard to hide the fact of a big crane out there with big bags of sand. What are you doing? Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm dropping bags in front of the gates because they're unsecured. And then you have to take them out later on when you want to open it. It's a very messy process that the whole world gets to see. So you waive that requirement, I think, in my mind, because you don't want anyone to know that you didn't secure those gates.
Well, that ties into one of the emails in this chain from, I believe, is the director of engineering in New Orleans, Walter Baume, who's talking about the fact that the public is going to be wanting to look at the water level gauges, going back to them, were connected to a website so that the public could see what the water level gauges were reporting. And the water level gauges were reporting goofy figures. I think the Times-Picayune, in fact, described the performance of the gauges in a heartwarmingly affectionate way as goofy and at the time. And he said in one of these emails, the public's going to want to know about these incorrect readings, so let's just shut it down.
I think I have his quote, and it was, if outfall gauges are unreliable, they should be turned off, in my opinion. Yeah. He goes on to say, we'll need to defend the unreliability as public will want access. Please provide your assessment. And here's the head person of engineering writing forward what he believes. He's basically saying the gauges are unreliable and he thinks they should be turned off. And he goes on to say that if the public wants or gets access to the malfunctioning gauge readings, the Corps will then have to defend that unreliability. And when I looked at this, this just bells went off for me. And I looked at this and I said, you know, this position that he takes serves absolutely no engineering purpose. You have to remember the context that this was communicated in. The context of this, when this email was sent, it was during the storm. And it was during the time of their reporting back and forth. If they had any inkling towards transparency and truthfulness, they would have communicated forward the malfunctioning gauges and the alternative measures that they were having to engage in to try and verify actual outfall canal water levels during the storm event, that going out into the storm and eyeballing it and sending back those readings. Mm-hmm. They didn't do this. They did the opposite, in fact. They reported forward no issues with the gauges. And they gave reported canal, and when they reported to those people embedded in the emergency ops center, they reported canal levels derived from what they presented as actual working gauges. And when you look at that email, when you look at the whole picture, that email, it constitutes an unacceptable position to take and to communicate forward. And it's really for nothing short of simply concealing apparent incompetence and decidedly embarrassing information. It has no other purpose.
You mentioned other problems aside from the gates, the pumps, the gauges. There were electrical system problems you mentioned. Do we know any more in detail about what those were, how those impacted the system?
To go back to London Outfall Canal with the electrical system failure, what happened there was also of significance in that they lost, they had a electrical system failure for the refueling system. And they lost that refueling system for half of the pumps there, leaving that outfall canal with 4 to 5 hours. Was from what I could tell from the internal email, they guesstimated about 4 to 5 hours of runtime left in them. So.
And this was during.
That was a very critical issue too.
And this was during the storm.
Yes, this was during the storm.
And do we know anything from the emails about what initiated the electrical system problem or what steps they were taking to ameliorate it?
I believe, and this is, I don't have any of those emails in front of me, but I believe some of them were rather trivial. Someone reported forward, I think, I'd have to go back and read it again, a gecko or something was fried. I don't remember what
that
was.
That rings a bell.
Something crawled in there and got itself fried and caused an issue.
Would that be a design problem, allowing geckos
no,
to
crawl? That's and get a better container.
Yeah.
A better enclosure.
Yeah. We're told that there may be more emails to come. You're inside the agency. Did this information, as it was filtering out over the last few weeks, come as a surprise to you?
No. I'm actually surprised that they got what they got, probably. But I think when I was reading through some of the verbiage of how he was getting these emails, it was very clear to me, knowing how you run projects and knowing how you send today. In today's, as with every profession, we live on Blackberries and iPhones, and there's a plethora of information that's there that should have been there that I didn't see. And I didn't like that. FOIA should be, when you ask for something, you get it. I suspect not all of it was there to get. So I don't know. There should have been a whole lot more there. He brought up the fact that attachments were not provided that were asked for. Mm. I think that's common. I don't know why. I'm not surprised by that. Largely because of my experience going through the same FOIA process, bringing my issues forward. Mm-hmm. I would hope that there would be more transparency, but that would come from an organization that's willing to put forward, again, here's the problem, here's what we see, here's what we're going to do with it and how we're going to fix it. And I'm not exactly, that has not been my experience. With this particular project in particular or district. And what I've seen instead has been there is no problem. And something else that I see repeated that's disturbing to me is, as the email from Mr. Balmy highlighted, if you don't turn it on, you don't have to report the data. if you don't turn it on and if you don't record it or if you don't have to report anything.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me is not, it shows a mindset. It shows an embedded culture instead of acknowledging what the problems are. It's hiding them and burying them and confusing them and, well.
Yeah. Are you happy not to be in New Orleans supervising the new pumping system?
Well, yes and no. Absolutely I am. I don't think that it would serve any purpose. I was very naive at the time, thinking that there would be responsiveness. I've since learned that that's not a possibility, and I'm glad to not be there on one level, but at the same time, I very much would want to be there because I think questions need to be asked, issues need to be pointed out, there needs to be more accountability, more transparency, and I would hope, there's no place, I think, for that. So I would belong there.
Maria, thank you for shedding some light on the emails. Oh, it's always good to talk to you, and continued good luck.
Thank you, Harry.
And now, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
First, some apologies from television personalities, or to them. The Swiss Tourism Office has apologized for the racism that Oprah Winfrey says she encountered last month while in town for Tina Turner's wedding. Oprah told Entertainment Tonight that a shop assistant in Zurich refused to show her a handbag that was, quote, too expensive, unquote. Racism for me doesn't show itself in the use of the N-word. It still exists, she said, and went on to explain what happened in the Zurich store. Obviously, she said, the Oprah Winfrey show is not shown in Zurich. I say to the woman, excuse me, may I see that bag right above your head? And she says to me, no, it's too expensive. She refused to get it, unquote. Now, the country's tourism officials have apologized for the clerk's behavior. We are very sorry for what happened to her, said Daniela Bear, a spokesman for the tourism office. The tourism office also tweeted that the salesperson acted terribly wrong in this case. This isn't Oprah's first bout of trouble while trying to buy a designer bag in 2005. She was turned away in Paris at the Hermes store after showing up 15 minutes after it closed. And CNN's chief medical correspondent, Dr. Sanjay Gupta, said this week he has reversed his opposition to medical marijuana. He apologized to the American people for having contributed to misleading the public about the potential medical benefits of the drug. This was his brain on the war on drugs. Gupta, who was promoting a new documentary about medical marijuana, admitted he has contributed to the misinformation being offered to the American public about the substance. Quote, I have apologized for some of the earlier reporting because I think you know we've been terribly and systematically misled in this country for some time, and I did part of that misleading. Unquote. He says he's not encountered a case of anyone dying of a marijuana overdose, contrasted with the relatively high death rates from abuse of prescription drugs. We have been terribly and systematically misled for nearly 70 years in the United States, and I apologize for my own role in that. Unquote. Dr. Sanjay Gupta. I apologize because I didn't look hard enough. Until now, I didn't look far enough. I didn't review papers from smaller labs in other countries doing some remarkable research, and I was too dismissive of the loud chorus of legitimate patients whose symptoms improved on cannabis. Instead, I mistakenly believed the Drug Enforcement Agency listed marijuana as a Schedule 1 substance because of sound scientific proof. They didn't have the science to support that claim, and I now know that. Australia has its own wiener. A married member of Australia's Queensland Parliament has apologized for sending sexually explicit messages and photographs to his mistress. MP Peter Dowling has resigned from his post as chairman of the Queensland Parliament's Ethics Committee. He's also stepping down from the Parliamentary Crime and Misconduct Committee. Quote, "I owe my family an apology. I'm sorry for the pain and embarrassment I caused you." He said, "I'm not proud of the events plastered all over the paper. I can't and won't defend any part of it." Dowling reportedly sent photographic images of his penis in a glass of red wine to his mistress. I'm sorry. White wine goes with... Oh, it's not really true. A YouTube video of a failed marriage proposal during a New Britain Rock Cats baseball game, minor league game, that went viral and was the subject of days of speculation was a hoax, a promotional skit, the minor league baseball team admitted this week. They have now apologized for the hoax. Not that minor league baseball is a hoax, you understand. Dateline Baltimore, American Airlines says breastfeeding mothers are welcome with no restrictions or requirements to cover up. The statement was released in the wake of a nurse-in protest staged at Baltimore Airport after a breastfeeding woman complained she'd been harassed by a flight attendant on a flight from L.A. to Washington in July. In an earlier letter to the woman, an airline customer service representative apologized for the incident but stated it was reasonable to ask a breastfeeding mother to cover up. The airline clarified after the protest this week, the letter we sent to the customer should have been more consistent with the language in our flight attendant manual, unquote. Dateline East Lothian, Scotland, the Bishop of Aberdeen, Hugh Gilbert, has apologized on behalf of the Catholic Church for decades of abuse of students at a boarding school in Scotland. Gilbert's apology was the first from a senior clergyman in response to evidence of physical and sexual abuse by monks at Fort Augustus Abbey School and its prep school in East Lothian. "It is a most bitter, shaming, and distressing thing that in this former Abbey school a small number of baptized, consecrated, and ordained Christian men physically or sexually abuse those in their care," said Gilbert. "All of us must surely pray for those who have suffered." A documentary by the BBC revealed the allegations Monday against the school. Against seven monks, the program revealed the Abbey was used as a dumping ground for clergymen who had previously confessed to abusing children. You got to dump them somewhere. Dateline London, London's Metropolitan Police apologized this week to the family of British newspaper vendor who died during demonstrations against the Group of 20 meeting in 2009. The force said it had reached an out-of-court settlement with the family of Ian Tomlinson. Officer Simon Harwood hit 47-year-old Tomlinson with a baton and shoved him to the ground. Then Tomlinson collapsed and died moments later. Scotland Yard acknowledged the suffering Tomlinson's family has endured with dignity over the past 4 years. "I apologize unreservedly for Simon Harwood's use of excessive and unlawful force, which caused Tomlinson's death," said Deputy Assistant Commissioner Maxine De Brunner. Harwood was tried and acquitted of manslaughter, but then fired. De Brunner added she took full responsibility for Harwood's actions. And Dateline Albuquerque, the company that runs the shuttle service to the Albuquerque Airport's rental car center, is apologizing after a driver allegedly ordered a gay couple to sit in the back of the shuttle bus. Standard Parking Incorporated, not any better than Standard, said it respects the equal rights of all customers and doesn't tolerate discrimination of any kind. He said the employee was suspended after the incident. According to a police report, one of the men involved said they'd been holding hands and that the driver ordered them to the back when one of them started to sing. Oh, and there's one more kind of apology. Godfrey Bloom is a member of the European Parliament representing a district in England as a member of the UK Independence Party, a party that is resolutely anti-European. This week in an interview, he was recorded by the Guardian newspaper as having said this.
"We've been let down time and time again. And how we can possibly be giving £1 billion a month when we're in this sort of debt to Bongo Bongo Land is completely beyond."
Now, his party, the UK Independence Party, has banned its representatives from saying the phrase Bongo Bongo Land. The chairman said the phrase was, quote, "an outdated description of foreign parts." Bloom himself appeared on BBC Radio later in the week.
"Now, where is Bongo Bongo Land, do you think?"
"Well, I don't know where Ruritania is either. There is no such place, of course, is there? Like the Third World. Where is the Third World?"
Yes, but what would you do if UKIP said to you, mind your language?
I'd say, righto, sorry, everybody. If I've offended anybody in Bongo Bongo Land, I shall write to the ambassador at the Court of St. James and apologise to him personally.
You can't stop, really, can you?
So a hypothetical apology for a usage that's a blast from the past.
Yes, the drums. Always the drums. Take me to Bongo, Bongo Land, where we can sit, watch the natives stand. It's oh so good for the imperial brand to swan about this exotic place. Meet me in Bongo, Bongo Town, we'll help keep the fuzzy wuzzies down. Whilst teaching them to revere the crown, they'll progress at their own slow pace. Bongo, Bongo Land, where the Tonga Wonga trees do sway. Mind the mud and the sand, only the hardiest stay till their dying day. Living in Bongo, Bongo Land, where we don't eat food that hasn't been canned. Helping folks is what we planned in exchange for an Air Force base. Bongo, Bongo Land, where the Tonga Wonga trees sway. Mind the mud and the sand, only the hardiest say till their dying day. So, farewell to Bongo, Bongoville, so vibrant and yet so still. Miss it? I don't think I will, as I rejoin the race. My footsteps I retrace. Take my hand, we're leaving Bongo, Bongo Land.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the East Coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.490 megahertz shortwave, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, on your smartphone through Stitcher.com, and available as a free podcast from Sideshow Network, iTunes, and around the world via the internet at two different locations, harryshearer.com and kcsn.org. And it'd be just like having your own secret back door if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much, Tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, in exile in Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. Thanks today to Brian Roth at Buzzy's in Los Angeles and Andrew Boyce at 5A Studio here in London for engineering help with today's broadcast. The email address for this program and the playlist for the music heard here on, as well as a fabulous store, all at your fingertips or your toe tips, if you go that way, at harryshearer.com. And me, I'm at the Harry Shearer on Twitter. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of the Change is Hard Radio Network. So long from London.